State of Wisconsin versus Armstrong, 97-095-0925, criminal, 97-0926, criminal. Counsel for the defendant, appellant.
May it please this honorable court and these honorable justices, I'm Stephen A. Cook, and I represent the defendant appellant, Tony Armstrong. We come to this court today on certification of four issues from the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. The facts of this case are that on July 13, 1995, Tony Armstrong was convicted of theft from person, which was his first criminal conviction. He was sentenced to 3 years probation and 4 months in the Racine County Jail. On July 31, 1995, Detective Mitch, a 20-year veteran of the Racine Police Department, and Detective Albro went to the Racine County Jail to interview Tony Armstrong at approximately 2:15 p.m. According to the testimony of Detective Mitch, Tony Armstrong was in custody serving a sentence on another matter at that time. Detectives Mitch and Albro met with Tony Armstrong on the main level intake area of the Racine County Jail for a one-hour interview, during which time Mr. Armstrong confessed to being involved in the death of Donald Thomas. Detective Mitch testified that he confronted Tony Armstrong with facts that Detective Mitch believed contradicted what Tony Armstrong was telling him. He told Tony Armstrong that he was getting off to a bad start with Detective Mitch. He indicated to Tony Armstrong that he did not believe Mr. Armstrong's story and that he thought he might be covering up for somebody else. Detective Mitch told Tony Armstrong he didn't believe that the route he took the night of the incident. He thought he was lying about that. He couldn't believe he traveled from Pearl Street in Racine to downtown Racine to get to the 3600 block of Spring Street. Detective Mitch testified that he told Tony Armstrong they didn't believe him when Tony Armstrong originally told them what happened at the store owned by Donald Thomas. This went on for approximately 45 minutes.
Counsel, can I clarify a fact, please? I don't like interrupting you this early, but you mentioned that they took him to an intake area. Was there other traffic going through that area at the time that they were doing this questioning? What were the physical surroundings?
Well, unfortunately, Justice Babbage, there's nothing in the record to indicate what the surroundings were. It says they took him to an interview room in the intake area on the main level of the Racine County Jail. That's the only evidence that's in the record as to the surroundings. Now, towards the end of this questioning and interrogation, Detective Mitch and Albro began to make arrangements to remove Tony Armstrong from the Racine County Jail, because during the course of the reckless homicide, Tony Armstrong removed Donald Thomas's keys and wallet from his person and disposed of them in another spot. So Detectives Mitch and Albro were going to take Tony Armstrong out of the jail so he could show them where this occurred. They decided that that wasn't really a good idea, and they asked Tony Armstrong to draw a map as to where this happened. Now, the testimony is conflicting, but near or at the end of the interview, right before the detectives were ready to leave, they finally Mirandized Tony Armstrong. And this happened after all of the questions had been asked and all of the answers had been given by Tony Armstrong. Now, Detective Mitch testified that Tony Armstrong was in custody. He also testified that Tony Armstrong was being interrogated by Detective Mitch. Now, right before they left, when they Mirandized Tony Armstrong, he signed a form acknowledging that he understood his rights. However, the bottom part of the form, where you waive your rights, he did not sign. Tony Armstrong was then taken back, and Detective Mitch and Albro went to recover the wallet and keys. After that happened, Detective Mitch went back to the police station, and he typed up what he called a sworn affidavit. And what was in that sworn affidavit was based entirely on the contents of the first interview, which was unwarranted. Approximately 2 hours after they originally left the Racine County Jail, Detective Mitch and Elbro went back to the Racine County Jail, and Tony Armstrong was again taken to the interview room at the intake area. At that point in time, Detective Mitch presented this typed-out sworn affidavit. He had Tony Armstrong go through it, cross out certain words, make changes, change some of the content, and at that point in time, after Tony Armstrong had done all of this, they re-Mirandized Tony Armstrong. At that point in time, Tony Armstrong then signed the waiver of rights for him. He then, the last thing that Tony Armstrong did at that point was sign the sworn statement and put his initials into the changes. Now, at the hearing at the trial court level, where the trial court denied the motions to suppress Tony Armstrong's two statements, the state stated at the end of all the evidence and in this argument that it was clear that Tony Armstrong was in custody here. Now, there are four issues that have been certified to this court for review. The first issue is, who has the burden of proof as to whether an individual is the subject of custodial interrogation? This is an issue of first impression in this state. This court has not issued any determination as to who has the burden of proof as to whether an individual is in custody or is interrogated. We first look at the seminal case in this area, which is Miranda. Miranda states that since the state is responsible for establishing the isolated circumstances under which the interrogation takes place. Now, what did the court mean when the court said that? What isolated circumstances? Well, the court meant that the state is responsible for establishing where did this happen? When did this happen? Who was there? What were the circumstances around it? What were the conditions of this? Was the officer wearing a sidearm? Did he have a badge? Did he tell the defendant that you're free to leave? You're not under arrest? You can go at any time? And the opinion of the defendant, that is what the U.S. Supreme Court meant when it said, since the state is responsible for establishing the isolated circumstances under which the interrogation takes place. Now, that sentence goes on to state, and has the only means of making available corroborated evidence of warnings given during incommunicado interrogation, then the burden of proof is rightfully on the state. Now, it's already been established that the state has the burden of proof to establish whether warnings were given, whether the Miranda warnings were properly given, and whether the confession was voluntary. It's the opinion of the defendant that the state also has the burden of proof as to whether the defendant was subjected to custodial interrogation based upon that language in Miranda. Legal versus Toomey, another United States Supreme Court decision, stated that the state has the burden of establishing the admissibility of a confession. Now, granted, that was a voluntariness case and a voluntariness issue, but the United States Supreme Court still stated that the state has the burden of establishing the admissibility of the confession. In Schultz versus State, this Supreme Court stated that the state, by demonstrating the conditions under which the defendant was informed of his rights. Again, the defendant takes that to mean that the state is responsible for establishing how the interrogation took place, where, when, who was there, how did it happen, what were the circumstances. California, People versus Wickfield, and according to the United States Supreme Court, California has stated that the state has the burden of establishing that the defendant was not in custody.
Also, what's the standard for the burden? Is it clear and convincing evidence, beyond a reasonable doubt? What is? If you say the burden is on the state, what level must the state establish their burden?
Well, that's an interesting question, Justice Babich. And in my opinion, I believe it should be clear and convincing evidence, which would be similar to other burdens that the state has to meet.
You would not hold them to a beyond a reasonable doubt burden?
No, that would not be consistent with the other burdens the state has.
Okay, then I'm going to ask you the same question I'm going to ask Mr. Becker. I'm somewhat perplexed as to the importance of this issue, why it's so important to both of you. Mr. Becker's brief on pages 32 and 33 talks, recites the mantra of "for all we know, for all we know." And I was thinking as I was reading that, but what is he really asking for? Because apparently, to meet the burden, all you would have to say is, in the answer to what Mr. Becker says, that he wasn't given a full opportunity to turn down the officer's request. Just allege in an affidavit to meet your burden and force the state to then answer this. You could allege in your affidavit that it took place in a surrounding which I was not fully acquainted, and it was a very oppressive surrounding, and you could allege that Tony Armstrong could allege that they never made it clear to me that I wasn't a suspect. In fact, I believed I was a suspect. It almost seems semantical what we're talking about here in burdens of proof. Why am I wrong? Why is this so important? Why are both of you fighting so hard for this?
I think because of what occurred in this case just established, was because of the record that was established, there's no evidence in the record as to what the surroundings exactly were. And I think that's why, in this particular case, why it's so important.
So the one who had the burden of proof failed, therefore, and if it was the state, you would say didn't show that it was a hostile environment.
Correct.
The state should show it was a friendly environment, that the defendant would leave the room and didn't have to answer questions.
Correct. And that information is peculiarly within the state's purview, in that they can put the officer on the stand and say, well, we told him he was free to leave. Just as in Oregon versus Mathiasen, when the United States Supreme Court said, well, if someone's told they're free to leave, they're free to leave. They're not under arrest. And so the state has that evidence, and that's why that's so important.
You could have subpoenaed them. Yeah. You could have subpoenaed the officer. It's not totally within the state's control.
But shouldn't the state...
Your answer, yes.
Yes, Chief Justice, you are correct in that regard.
Shouldn't the state have some kind of warning as to what it is you believe was oppressive or made these circumstances involuntary? And shouldn't you have to come forward when you're going to claim that this was an in-custody interrogation, that in fact there's some kind of minimal level of standards that were not met?
Well, I think
otherwise they're almost being forced to prove a negative.
Well, but and proving a negative is one of the things that is addressed in the McFerrin decision. When you're establishing burdens of proof, proving a negative that someone is not in custody is not a hard thing for the state to do. And the court is right in filing a motion. The defendant should make certain allegations in that motion. However, there is a statute in the state of Wisconsin, 971.31 sub 3, which states, the admissibility of any statement of the defendant shall be determined at the trial by the court in an evidentiary hearing out of the presence of the jury, unless the defendant by motion challenges the admissibility of such statement before trial. And the legislature has stated that, so automatically, whenever there's a defendant's statement that's going to be brought into evidence, there's going to be a hearing as to whether it should be admissible. And I think that changes the perspective a little bit, and I don't think the defendant should, for purposes of trial court time and the importance of that, should wait until the trial, and when the state comes forward and says, well, we want to introduce this statement, should then stand up and object.
You challenge the admission of the statement before trial.
That occurred in this case?
Yes. And what did you do? Did you just file an affidavit or just a motion?
A motion and an affidavit was filed.
And what did the affidavit say?
The affidavit stated that recited information that was contained in the police report. There is approximately an 8-paragraph affidavit filed by trial counsel, which is in the appendix.
Pages
7-2 and 7-3. And it was filed by the trial counsel for the defendant, who reiterated in approximately 4 to 5 paragraphs what was contained in the police report.
Right. So would it be your position, if I understood Justice Babbage's question, he's saying even if you didn't have the burden of proof, you had a burden of producing sufficient evidence to put the state on its burden of proof?
Yes.
And you're saying the sworn affidavit was enough?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Looking at the McFerrin policy, in which this court has established 5 factors to determine who has the burden of proof, the first one is a natural tendency to place the burden on the party desiring change. Now, that means, according to State v. McFerrin, that the burden of pleading and proof with regard to most facts have been and should be assigned to the plaintiff, who generally seeks to change the present state of affairs and who therefore should be expected to bear the risk of failure of proof and persuasion. And the defendants believe that it's the state that is trying to change the present state of affairs, because the state is trying to introduce a statement to prove the defendant guilty, and the defendant is innocent until proven guilty. In addition, this is a piece of evidence that the state has to lay a foundation in order to get it into evidence.
Counsel, you've got 3 other issues.
Yes.
You've got 25 minutes.
Thank you.
Much of which has lapsed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The second issue is the issue of custody and was Tony Armstrong in custody. Now, the seminal case on this particular sort of facts is Mathis versus United States. And in Mathis, an individual was in jail on another offense, similar to Mr. Armstrong. Internal Revenue agents came and questioned him. And the United States Supreme Court ruled that he was in custody and was under interrogation at that point in time. That's supported by statements in the Mathiasen case.
Are you arguing for a per se rule?
I am not arguing for a per se rule. And the reason for that is because it would impact incidents that occur in the prison setting where someone commits a crime in prison and is questioned by prison administrators.
So you are then arguing, I take it, for a totality of circumstances rule?
Well, I believe there's a different situation. I'm asking this court to adopt the Mathis ruling.
Your answer to Justice Babbage indicated this is a different kind of case. That in a case that involves a crime that doesn't occur in the prison but out or in the jail, then are you asking for a per se rule then?
Yes, when it occurs outside of the jail and when there's questioning by governmental agents that are not part of the prison administration.
But not a per se rule if it relates to a violation of a prison rule or a statute that relates to the prison.
Yes, or if a crime's committed, a homicide in the prison. And that is actually supported by the cases cited by the state. And if you read the footnote 5 in U.S. versus Connolly, that states that the district court appears to apply the Mathis rule consistent with the Cervantes versus Walker rule, added imposition of freedom standard when it excluded statements made by Connolly to an FBI investigator, viewing the latter as in a different category when you read the cases. He's an outside agent who has come in, and under Mathis, I think I have to suppress and grant the motion as to that individual. And in fact, Cervantes versus Walker the seminal case that the state relies upon specifically distinguishes between those two circumstances and specifically refers that it applied the test to an inmate questioned about conduct inside the facility by a member of the prison staff. And that's what I'm asking for this court to draw a distinction on. Now, the third issue is an issue of whether Mr. Armstrong was interrogated. And the court has heard the fact situation. He was questioned extensively, questioned confrontationally. Different definitions have been handed down over the course of the years. It's kind of evolved as to what constitutes interrogation. Miranda says questioning initiated by law enforcement officers after a person has been taken into custody. Rhode Island versus Sinnes further clarified that and stated that the Miranda comes into play whenever a person in custody is subjected to express questioning or its functional equivalent. Berkemer versus McCarty stated that if police take a suspect into custody and ask him questions. Now, interrogation, according to Hoffman versus United States, the right against self-incrimination embraces not only what may actually incriminate you, but what would furnish a link in the chain of evidence, which is what we have in this case, is the police officers went there. According to the testimony of Detective Mitch, he wasn't a suspect, but they began questioning because they wanted a link in the chain of evidence. State versus Cunningham set forth a five-factor test, whether there is interrogation or not.
Counsel, it seems like you're saying that any time they interview a witness, that they should be giving the Miranda then, because the only reason they're interviewing a witness is because the witness may give some information that is a link in the chain of evidence.
But the witness, the individual, would also have to be in custody, Justice Bradley. And if the police, for example, invite someone down to the police station and say, come on down and talk to us, we want to talk to you about this, and they tell the individual, you don't have to talk to us, you're free to go at any time, you're not under arrest, then Miranda would not come into play because that individual is not in custody.
Okay, but look, aren't custody and interrogation two different issues? So let us assume for the moment that the man is in custody. It may not be interrogation, right?
Correct.
All right, so I think the question is, here, the person's in custody, but he's not a suspect. It's would questioning witnesses if he were on the street. So what is it about the questions asked here that make it interrogation? And let's just put him out on the street. It would be interrogation on the street. I know Miranda wouldn't apply because we don't have custody, but we're just focusing on the interrogation. Or is it wrong to separate the two?
Well, the confrontation nature of the question, the fact that they challenged his credibility, that they said they didn't believe him, that they said, we have a witness here who can directly contradict what you're telling me. The fact that they said, I don't believe you're out of travel. I don't believe you. You're covering for somebody. That's a very confrontational style of questioning.
Confrontational is so, I mean, if that in and of itself is your response, that's so subjective. You know, what? Confrontational to who? To the reasonable person? Confrontational to the one asking the questions? Confrontational to the one receiving the questions? I mean.
Well, the third element in the Cunningham issue is the focus is supposed to be primarily upon the perception of the person being questioned. And so we would have to look then at the perception of the individual who is being questioned by the police officers in this case.
What import, if any, do we give to what I think is the finding of fact here by the trial judge, that the officer was truthful when he said he didn't even though I asked, he asked him all of the questions that were incriminating, he didn't think that he was a suspect, and it was at that moment when finally it popped into his head, who, he may be a suspect. I gave him Miranda. Of course, all the questions are already asked and he answered. But the trial court said, I believe that, and I understand that was a finding of fact. What import is that in our standard of review?
Well, the standard of review is this court has to accept the historical findings of fact, but I don't believe that that is a relevant or a proper finding of fact, because Miranda focus took the shift or shifted the issue of, it's not the focus of the question or the focus of the police officer, it's what would a reasonable person believe. And even Cunningham says the subjective intent of the officers is not relevant.
Do you believe that he should have been Mirandized prior to them initiating any questions?
Either Mirandized, or he should have been advised that you do not have to talk to us, you can leave us...
Right at the beginning?
Yes, Justice Bradley.
Okay, now, let's assume that we hold against you on that they didn't have to do that. Was there a point at which you think clearly established that these police officers had to know that this guy was a suspect? And at least at that point should have been Mirandized.
Well, once he told them that he was directly involved and caused the death of Donald Thomas, at that point in time...
Is that the first point, really, that you think they realized that he was a suspect?
Well, they must have, and it's hard because the record is not that clear, Justice, but I think at that point in time, the light bulb probably should have gone on, or even before that, when he directly contradicted what this other witness said. No, I was in the store after Mr. Chernowski left. I was back viewing a peep show. And when he said something to that effect, then perhaps a light bulb should have gone on and said, this gentleman may be a defendant in the future because he was there.
You did not set that up as an alternative argument in your brief, though, did you?
No, I did not, Justice Bradley. And I notice my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have time for a rebuttal. Beckwith? Beckard, sorry. Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
May it please the court, as the Chief Justice has just indicated, I'm Assistant Attorney General David Becker, and I'm appearing here this morning on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. The court has before it ultimately two issues to decide, and that is the admissibility of the oral statements that the defendant gave to the police officers during the interrogation that's been described by opposing counsel, which oral statements were all made before Miranda warnings were administered. And then the second ultimate issue that this has to decide is whether or not a subsequent written statement, and opposing counsel has described the circumstances under which that written statement was given, whether that statement should be suppressed, that statement having been given after the administration of Miranda warnings and a waiver of Miranda warnings twice. First, at the conclusion of the first interview, right on the heels of the defendant's oral statements, there was an administration of Miranda warnings and a waiver at that time, and then right before the written statement was given, a second waiver of rights was obtained. And in that regard, I should just make one point, and that is, while I think the opposing counsel clearly concedes that immediately before the giving of the written statement, there was a full administration of Miranda warnings and a full waiver of Miranda rights as evidenced by the written form, both parts of which the defendant signed, namely the rights portion and then the waiver portion. I understand opposing counsel, at least implicitly, if he hasn't explicitly said it, to be questioning whether or not there was a waiver of Miranda rights a couple of hours earlier at the conclusion of the defendant's giving of the oral statements when Miranda warnings were first administered. Opposing counsel admits, as he must, that Miranda warnings were administered there. The record is absolutely unequivocal on that point. But he contends that because the defendant didn't sign that waiver form down at that waiver portion at the bottom of the form, I think he's suggesting that there was no waiver. And I would simply point the court to the fact that there is clear testimony from the officers, which was credited by the trial court, that the defendant affirmatively indicated his willingness to continue to talk to the police officers at that time. And we contend that that was a waiver, and that the fact that the defendant refused to sign the waiver form does not in any way undercut that conclusion. And in that regard, we direct the court's attention, as we did at footnote 10 of our brief, to the United States Supreme Court's decision in North Carolina versus Butler, in which the court noted with apparent approval that, quote, courts of appeals have unanimously rejected the argument that refusal to sign a written waiver form precludes a finding of waiver.
Okay, now that waiver was given after much of the oral testimony.
That waiver was basically given after all of the oral statements were given. But I want to make the point, because I think he is implicitly making something big of the fact that they went back with that written statement, got him to make all the corrections on the written statement, do everything with regard to the written statement, got him all ready to sign it, and said, wait a second, now we want to get a waiver from you just before you attach your signature. Well, it wasn't quite that way. 2 hours earlier, they had gotten a complete waiver of his Miranda rights from him.
You're saying that 2 hours earlier, Miranda warning was enough for the written statement?
It would have in itself have been enough, and combined with a second waiver then, written waiver.
After he looked at it.
Oh.
But if we don't like that, after he read the written, you have a carryover.
I have a much earlier administration of warnings and a much earlier waiver, so that you need not be concerned about that.
Mr. Becker, before we get into these issues about burden of proof and custody and interrogation, let me go back to the last points with your opposing counsel. Do you believe that any point during that first interview, the time period between, I think, 2 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, should the police have given him a Miranda? At some point, he became more than simply a witness, didn't he?
All I can say with regard to that is that as I read the record, it appears that when he first began to make his incriminating statements, the officers did not believe that he was telling the truth. It was in that respect that I think we have to read his testimony about, I thought he was covering up for somebody, and that the officer testified...
Which in itself would be a crime.
Well, comma.
Cut right to the chase. At some point, he should have been Mirandized in that first hour, shouldn't he?
Well, he clearly should. I think he should have been Mirandized when the officer believed that he, in fact, was giving incriminating statements. And I don't know that the officer even thought about the possibility of obstruction of justice. I mean, he was obviously focusing on trying to get information about this crime. And that's where I think what is so critical is what Justice Bradley pointed out, and that is the finding of fact by the trial court. The trial court clearly found that he was not a suspect, and that it was only when the officer finally realized that these were in fact incriminating statements that could be credited, that the officer then at that point did administer the Miranda warnings.
Well, on page 39 of your brief,
Yes. Thank you.
You say, conceitedly, under the objective test to be applied in this context, so you accept the Ennis Cunningham tests, right?
Yes, obviously. That's the controlling authority.
The trial court's finding that the defendant was not a suspect is not dispositive of the issue, but it is clearly relevant. Why is it relevant? And then you go on and you cite, the Carter case? You cite People v. Wader, and then you say, which deals with the fact that in that case, the police didn't think he was a suspect. And you go on that way. And I don't know why, what's the difference between certainly relevant and not dispositive? How is it not dispositive?
Well, it's not dispositive because under the cases you just indicated, and the test is an objective one. And so so what I am saying...
Why is it even relevant? I mean, what the view of...
Well, I go on there at the top of page 40, I think, and try and explain why I think so, and that is that where I say, if the circumstances viewed objectively do not render the defendant a suspect. And that's the situation here, is that the officers had no reason to believe that he had been involved in the crime. That's what they testified to. That's what the judge credited.
But at some point, prior to them giving him his Miranda, they clearly knew that he was a suspect. I mean, all of a sudden they found out. I mean, he admitted that he was there when they thought that he wasn't. He admitted shaking him. In fact, at some point he started describing where this property was. And yet all of that came prior to being given Miranda. Didn't it?
And all...
Am I correct? All of that came prior to
yes.
being given Miranda?
Yeah, yeah. The record is clear on that, that all of these incriminating statements were made prior to that. And all I can say is that during that whole course of that time, the officers were not sure, even at that point, that he was, in fact, telling them the truth. In fact, did not believe them. In fact, were challenging them. The testimony with regard to that whole sequence of events there and exactly what he was challenged on, I think among other things, it seems to me the officers were challenging him on his attempt to confess to this crime, but they really did not believe him, and they really did not think that he was making incriminating statements, at least with respect to this crime. But if you want a bottom line from the state's perspective, I will read you what I said in my brief. I have to concede this is an extremely close question. Again, and part of this is a result of the fact that the record isn't exactly clear. Because we don't know exactly the order in which these admissions came, what came first, what, you know, and where you'd have to draw that line. And it seems to me, too, that, you know, I don't know if we can demand the kind of precision that we're talking about here. If all of a sudden, in the course of talking to a person that you didn't think was involved in the crime, he starts answering these questions and starts incriminating himself, it seems to me there's got to be a little leeway in allowing the officer to maybe kind of flesh it out a little bit and find out, you know, what's really going on here and what he's really saying. And to suggest that at the instant where there was first some indication that he may have actually been on the scene or that he may have actually been responsible for the actions that caused the victim's death, that somehow right at that precise moment we have to slice this so fine that the officers then at that point had to give Miranda warnings. I'm not so sure that that's very realistic. I'm not so sure that that comports with a sound administration of the Miranda rule. It seems to me there's got to be a little give and a little leeway. And when they're in this kind of situation, I think they've got to be allowed to at least get a little bit more developed.
Sure, I'll give you that. I've been present at many of these and understand that situation. But I'm also asking these questions because I'm not sure that I understand your custody argument. Are you saying that, well, let's assume there was a bright line. At some point this guy says, okay, you got me. You know, so there's a real bright line at which the officers intend to continue on interrogating him. Now, in your custody argument, you state that he was not in custody and therefore Miranda does not apply. However, if there had been that bright line, do you still stand by your custody argument, or does Miranda have to be applied there anyway, under any circumstances, whether he's in the Racine County Jail or on the street? Do you understand that?
I think I understand the question, and I think I would answer it this way. I'm not so sure that in this situation where the defendant is already in jail, as opposed to a defendant who is out on the street in his home or whatever, and who then is going to be, once he gives these Once he gives these incriminating statements, officers are going to announce, well, we've now got probable cause to arrest you, and by golly, we're going to arrest you, and you are under arrest, and we're going to take you down to the police station, either from your home, from the street, wherever we've conducted this questioning, or in the case of, as some of the cases are, the fellow voluntarily comes to the police station, and now, as in your filial case, which isn't cited in the briefs, but that I took a look at yesterday because I was concerned about this question, the officer concludes with regard to this person who's voluntarily before them, because he's come down voluntarily to answer questions, that with regard to that fellow who now the officer says, I'm going to arrest you, you're not going to be free to leave from this point on, clearly at that point the man is in custody and warnings are required. I have a real hard time figuring out how in this kind of a situation where the officer is not really going to at this point subject this man to any would not normally, I would think, not be, and in this case there's no evidence that there was any increase in his custody as a result of these statements.
Yeah, that's where I'm pushing you. You get it. Because
I think we've got a situation where it never ripens into custody, whereas it might have if we didn't have this jailhouse-type situation.
Yeah, I'm pushing you on whether or not your custody argument, whether you stand by your custody argument under all circumstances. In a jailhouse setting.
That's even if I have to concede on interrogation that there became a point where this turned into interrogation because the officer, as a reasonable man, would have to realize that he was now trying to elicit incriminating responses, which is the test. Even in that situation, I would say that the question of custody, that does not resolve the question of custody because we are not going to have any change in this guy's custodial status from what it was. Where, unlike the situations I've just described, where now the guy's he's given incriminating statements to give the police probable cause for his arrest, and he is indeed arrested and either taken into custody if he's not already down, you know, at the police station, or is in the police station and where we announce you came down here freely, but now you're not free to go anymore.
Summarize your argument. You can win either because he's not in custody or because there is no interrogation.
That's absolutely correct.
Even if there was interrogation, your argument is not in custody. I don't understand your interrogation argument. If the standard is viewing the matter objectively from the defendant's perspective.
Yeah. No, well, yeah, from the defendant's... go on.
I'm quoting.
Yes, no, I know.
So why here, viewing it objectively from the defendant's perspective, the defendant knows that... didn't he strike him here? The victim, well, it doesn't matter. He was involved in this homicide from the defendant's perspective.
Excellent question. If my brief hadn't hit a 50-page page limit, and if I hadn't thought that my interrogation argument wasn't my weakest, I probably should have developed that much in much more detail and responded to this precise question, and the response would be this. In these contexts where we apply reasonable objective tests, reasonable man tests, from the perspective of the defendant, which is also the kind of test we apply in determining questions of arrest and in determining other questions, you know, in the Fourth Amendment area, the law, I think, is clear. I can't cite you off the top of my head a case, but I think the law is clear that when we're talking about a reasonable man in the defendant's position, we are talking about a reasonable, innocent man. I think that's...
if it's reasonably innocent, no, there's never interrogation that's going to elicit and incriminate.
No, quite the contrary, because a reasonable, innocent person can be confronted with questioning that clearly indicates that the police think, while he is innocent, the police think he is guilty and is in fact, and that they are in fact attempting to elicit from him incriminating responses. So,
he's not going to be incriminating because he's innocent.
Pardon me?
He's not going to be incriminating because he's innocent.
Counsel, look,
well, we have no innocent people that have ever been accused of crime. Yes, a person can be innocent, and there can be incriminating evidence indicating they are guilty of a crime of which they are innocent.
Counsel, I'm sorry for taking up so much time, but I want to get this clear. my head as to what your position is, and maybe I can do it by just changing the facts just a little bit. Let's assume that the police officers testified, all of them, that at 2:30, one half hour into this, they realized that Mr. Armstrong was a suspect, that in fact he may well have been the perpetrator of this crime. So we've got a bright line where the officers testify, this is it. Is it your position, nevertheless, that the police did not have to Mirandize him at that point because he was not, quote, in custody for purposes of Miranda?
I think that if there was no concurrent change in his custodial status, that he would not be in custody.
So
if he was still free to get up out of that interview room and walk back to his cell, I don't think that there was any custody.
So it doesn't really matter for you whether there's interrogation or not. He wasn't in custody.
It only matters in the sense that we want to lay out both potential arguments here, and I have conceded here today and conceded in my brief that the interrogation argument is the weaker of the two. I think it's one that you're going to have to wrestle with, and I'm not so sure I don't think it's completely cut and dried. And I think part of the problem with regard to that argument and making a determination with interrogation just as with custody is the fact that the record is very unclear as to exactly the sequence of events and the nature of the question that went on and exactly what they were challenging him on. And I think, by the way, that some of the contentions that were made here this morning about talking about that I've got a witness that will contradict you, I don't remember reading that in the transcript, but maybe I'm wrong. I have a feeling that might be in some police report that's not part of the record, but maybe I'm wrong on that. But I encourage the court to review the transcript with regard to exactly what the facts were. But I think the court will find it relatively unsatisfactory because a lot of these questions are left unanswered. And that then brings us back to the question that Justice Bablich put to opposing counsel, and I think was the question that he said he was going to put to me, and that is, what's the importance of the custody issue?
No,
and I think in the abstract...
The burden of proof issue.
I'm sorry, the burden of proof issue. And that's what I meant to address here. My notes were wrong. The burden of proof issue, in the abstract and in terms of looking into future cases, it may not make a great deal of difference because once one or the other of the parties is put on notice that they have the burden of proof with respect to this issue, then... both sides are probably in a position to adduce the evidence that is necessary to resolve that. One party may or may not be in a better position with respect to some parts of the question as opposed to other parts of the question, or some factors that are to be considered as opposed to other factors that are to be considered. But with respect to this case, it is critical. And I think we're learning how critical it is by what I've talked about, what I've just mentioned about the record not being clear, and I heard my opponent saying exactly those same words during his closing argument in response, or during his argument here this morning, in response to questions that the record is not clear, and that's the problem here, and that's why the burden of proof is so important, because if the burden of proof is on the state, then I don't think we have established that affirmatively that there wasn't custody, and I think we probably have not affirmatively established that there was an interrogation. By the same token, if the burden of proof is on the defendant, clearly he has not shown anything that would be an indicia of custody over and above the normal custody that attended his status as a jail.
That's the question then. Okay. It's your position then that he's got to show something over and above just being in jail.
That's what I think the vast majority of the cases, if not the uniform authority on this subject, says.
And what factors or what would you be looking for
to show
that it's over and above?
We cite one case which has been invoked in a number of other cases that lays out four factors, and I'm not sure there's any that these are particularly... need to be the precise four factors. They clearly, I don't think, are the only factors, but they talk about the language used to summon the defendant, the physical surroundings of the interrogation.
They ask the defendant to come with me. Can the defendant in jail say no?
Well,
an officer comes to him in his cell and he says, come with me, we want to question you. Well, just come with me. Can he say no? Is that a violation of a jail rule?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
But we don't know if that's what happened or whether the officers went and said, we would like to talk to you. Would you be willing to accompany us down to the interview room?
Please.
Please.
Right. Okay.
So we don't know on that. We have no evidence whatsoever with respect to that factor. Physical surroundings of the interrogation. Justice Bablich, I was one of the earliest, and that may be your first question to opposing counsel. What were the surroundings? Were there people going by, or was this really the incommunicado? You didn't put it this way, but I think what you had in mind was, is this the incommunicado interrogation that Miranda was concerned about, where a person is swept off and sequestered in an area that other people don't, that the public doesn't have access to?
This was an interview room. Usually has a door. Does it matter if the door is open or closed?
I think absolutely it matters. I think that's part of the physical surroundings of the interrogation. Now, is it dispositive? No, not by a long shot. Does it matter? Yes, that's the kind of evidence we'd like to know. The third factor of the four that we called out of a decision in our brief is extent to which defendant was confronted with evidence of guilt. Here, I think, although the record is not absolutely clear on this, as I said, it looks to me like the police, when he started to indicate he was guilty, challenged whether he was telling the truth about that. And so I think we have the exact opposite position of being confronted with evidence of guilt. We have the situation where even when he was starting to render incriminating statements, he did not, he was not necessarily believed. And clearly we did not have him being confronted with any evidence of guilt because the officers did not think he was guilty. They had no evidence against him. They thought he had been a visitor earlier in the evening on the premises, the business premises on which the homicide occurred. The final factor that that decision talks about is additional pressure exerted to detain defendant. We have absolutely nothing to indicate that the defendant was ever told that he was told that he had to come, or believed that he had to come, that he was not given a choice, and we have no indication that during the course of the interview, the defendant ever suggested that he might want to leave and the police stopped him. We have no reason to believe that the defendant wasn't free to simply get up and walk out of that room at any time he wanted. And I think that's probably, those are four factors that are looked at, but I think maybe ultimately the question probably boils down to one of, was he free to leave that interview room? And if he could have gotten up and walked out at any point in that interview process, then I don't think he was that he was in custody. And we simply don't have any evidence in this record to demonstrate that he wasn't free to get up and walk out. We also don't have any evidence to demonstrate that he was free to get up and walk out. And that brings us back to why the burden of proof issue is so important, because in the absence of the evidence either way, whoever bears the burden of proof is going to lose.
Counsel, on the issue of interrogation, it seems to me that the trial court committed error because the trial court used the subjective perspective of the officer as to when the defendant was a suspect and therefore needed to be Mirandized, as opposed to the reasonable person test or the objective test. So to that extent, the trial court committed error. Would you agree or disagree with that assertion?
To the extent that that's how you read the trial court's decision, and I think it can probably be read that way, that's wrong. I mean,
the trial court was wrong. The trial court committed
error.
The
evidence is in this case, I'm not so sure that the trial court's decision is.
That is an error of law, it seems to me, because it's applying the wrong standard. Oftentimes we say, oh, it's a finding of fact, and therefore we give deference to the finding of facts. But here you have to decide when Miranda has to be administered, when he was a suspect is an important line drawing.
I'm not going to concede that the trial court's decision is not all that clear.
Mr. Becker, please stand in front of the microphone.
I'm sorry. I'm going to read the final sentence of his decision. The final sentence of his decision with regard to the admissibility of the first statement and whether there was custodial interrogation, so I find that they did comply with Miranda with once they were apprised and knew that he in fact was a suspect in the matter and that the statements made on that occasion were voluntary by Mr. Armstrong. That's page 19 of the transcript in which that decision was made. And he says that he knew in fact that he was a suspect. I don't know. Is he applying an objective test or a subjective test there? But the bottom line is it doesn't make any difference. We know what the law is. And that is,
it has to be subjective. So when
it's not subjective. It has to be objective.
And
yeah.
So when the court arguably on pages 18 and 19 essentially says, I believe the officer when he says that he didn't think he was a suspect until such a point of time.
If he says, I believe the officer when he says that, that's clear, that's very important. That's a finding of fact, and like I say, that's relevant to this objective determination that we have to make. But if he goes on to say, and because of that belief, I cannot find that he was ever subject to interrogation, I think he would have to be wrong, because it's more than just the officer's belief that has to be considered.
Counsel,
on the standard of who has the burden of proof, we've got a number of cases, I think, that say that the Miranda and Goodchild hearings can be held together and that the same procedures apply to both, right?
Correct.
So in the Goodchild, who has the burden of proof?
Clearly the state.
So why, with that line of cases, isn't the burden of proof here in the Miranda cases on you? I mean, there are cases that say, we conclude that Miranda, like Goodchild, should require a hearing by the trial judge. We apply the procedures and rules. I mean, I'm just happen to be looking at Roney, but there are other cases like that.
Well, I think there's, if I can just add to and make my case even tougher, on Miranda, on the other Miranda issues, the ones that we normally confront in a case, which is, were Miranda warnings administered and was there a valid Miranda rights, we have the burden of proof. So within the context of Miranda itself, the state has the burden of proof on those two questions, so why shouldn't it have a burden of proof on the earlier question? I think that's even tougher for me.
All right, I'll give you that one too.
And I guess it's what we laid out in our brief. That's just that is not how the courts, basically the courts that have confronted this in other jurisdictions, with one exception, California, at least that's the only exception that I'm aware of. Now, whether your research digging deeper will find others, but I found no others in the course of my research. With that one exception, all of the cases that I could find that directly address this issue have all said that the burden is on the state to prove that initial issue of whether or not there's been custodial interrogation. Yeah. And I don't think the passage from Miranda...
You said burden on the state.
Burden on the defendant. We're obviously approaching the end of my argument. I'm talking even faster than I normally talk. I'm going to misstate, but you'll understand, I'm sure.
I just put the tape recorder on slow.
Exactly. Miranda, that passage from Miranda, and I won't go into it because I have so little time here, but the passage from Miranda that he points to, I don't think at all is addressing this question of who has the burden of showing custodial interrogation. It is addressing the question of who has the burden on those other two issues of were Miranda warnings given and was a valid waiver obtained.
Didn't we write a case a year or two ago that said that the defendant has some burden of coming forward and showing the particular areas of alleged error?
I do not. I'm off the top of my head.
A motion, I think, to suppress evidence.
I believe it was, yeah.
Which said that you just can't make a motion to suppress evidence. You have to just give some indication of why. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know whether that would, without going back and looking at that decision, I don't know whether it would have some application here. But we have the U.S. Supreme
Court. The application that I'm thinking of is that wouldn't it be enough for the defendant to simply state with particularity where, why he believes the this was in custody? How far does he have to go to meet that burden?
I would say he has to go so far. I would say on the basis of the authority that I've cited, and on the basis of the United States Supreme Court's decision in Berkefer versus McCarty, which specifically talked about the defendant not having demonstrated custodial interrogation, that the defendant would ultimately has the ultimate burden of actually persuading, not simply coming forward with evidence. But I will say by way of footnote to that, that I don't believe that even if you simply assign a burden of coming forward with evidence to a defendant, that the defendant in this case has sustained that burden. Because while he did, as he indicated, file a motion to suppress, to which was attached the affidavit of his counsel laying out some facts from the police report, I don't think any of those facts begin to start to address these factors that have to be addressed, at least to decide the question of custody. They may address in some way the question of whether or not interrogation was going on, because they do refer to the fact that the defendant was being challenged and things like that with respect to his statements. But
the middle burden of persuasion?
No, not the middle burden. This is clearly a preponderance of the evidence situation. I think that the air has now cleared on that in Wisconsin, and both with respect to Miranda issues and with respect to voluntariness issues, the burden is on the standard is preponderance of the evidence.
It used to be
beyond a reasonable doubt in both contexts, and that has evolved over the last few years, particularly coming off of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that made that absolutely clear.
Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Thank you.
Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'd like to address the elements that the state has listed with regards to determining when an individual is in custody, although I don't necessarily agree with them, but I'd like to approach those and discuss those a little bit. The first one the state talks about is the language used to summon the defendant, and as the Chief Justice astutely pointed out, perhaps if he doesn't go with the officer, that is a violation of jail rules, and he could be thrown into secured, even more secure detention, or the hole, or some sort of room. With regards to the physical surroundings of the interrogation, now Orozco versus Texas does not apply to prisoners, but Orozco says that a person can be in custody even in their own bedroom. And so what the state is asking to do here is to apply a different standard to people who are incarcerated on other charges than to those who are outside in the general public. And if you look at the cases cited by the state, not only do they almost uniformly involve prisoners who committed crimes in prison and questioned by prison administrations, they almost uniformly find that there is no change in the physical surroundings because they're familiar with it, such as when an individual is questioned in the library or in a conference room. Then the state talks about the extent to which the defendant was confronted by evidence of his guilt. I think that's more of an interrogation type of approach and not whether someone is actually in custody or not, because this four-factor test the state sets forth is actually deals with custodial interrogation and not just custody.
Counsel, you're running out of time, and I'd like to get to one other issue. Because Mr. Becker's position is that if all else fails, nevertheless, the second confession comes in. And he points out in his brief that you depend primarily upon Wong's son, the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. And he points out, and I think somewhat persuasively, that that really does not have application here, that there has been subsequent case law that would admit this statement. And I think you've got a pretty big hurdle there to overcome. I wish you'd spend a minute or two addressing that.
I appreciate that, Justice Babagin. I think not only do I refer to Wong Sun, but I refer to the Court of Appeals decision in State versus Ambrosia, as well as the Eighth Circuit decision in United States versus Carter. And those two opinions come after the Oregon versus Alstead opinion, which is basically the primary citation relied upon by the state. Now, The difference is...
But Ambrosia relied on Wong-Sung.
That's correct, and also relied on Elstead and distinguished, just established the difference between Elstead, wherein the defendant in Elstead made one statement that, yes, I was there. And then he was taken to the police department and disgorged everything that he knew about the offense. We have a different factual situation in this case and in Ambrosia, where, especially in this case, where the defendant gave everything up that he knew about the offense before he was Mirandized, and then he reconfessed after that. And the Carter decision, which interprets Elstead...
Was he given his Miranda before he went through this written document?
He was given Miranda at approximately 3 p.m., approximately 2 hours before he went through this written document.
He was given two Mirandas, right? One at 3 and then one after he looked over the written one.
Yes, Chief Justice, that's correct. And he was given Miranda then, and then the police went and prepared this. And then he changed everything, and then they regave him Miranda, and then he signed an initial. And Carter is almost right on point, where United States versus Carter, where Carter was being questioned in an office area of his work, and he confessed to everything that he had been involved with before Miranda. And then they Mirandized him. And what I want to address in Elstead is the footnote that addresses Justice Brennan's decision, because that specific, Justice Brennan's dissent, because that specifically refers to this kind of a factual scenario where the majority explicitly rejected Justice Brennan's statement that Elstead dealt a crippling blow to Miranda by permitting the police to withhold warnings until the end of interrogation, and then give the warnings and then have the defendant reconfess. It also accused Justice Brennan in his dissent of inviting trial courts and prosecutors to distort the holding and the reasoning of Elstead to do just this particular thing, which is to get a full confession, then Mirandize, and I notice my time is up.
You may finish your sentence and then answer Justice Battles.
Then Mirandize, and then get the whole confession again.
Well, Mr. Becker points out that in Carter, the time period that distinguished the two events was nearly indistinguishable, whereas here, that you've got maybe more than a two-hour time difference from the time of the alleged initial violation to the point where... How do you answer that?
Well, how I answer that is the case that Mr. Becker cites in support of that proposition is United States versus Gales, and that is not the only factual underpinning which Gales relied upon. Gales also, there was only one improper question.